Okay then, so this is God's complaints against the nations, these are the nations that we're talking about, from chapters 13 to 23 of Isaiah. And the complaints result in the judgment which will come upon these nations. Before we look at these chapters, I want to define exactly what the role of a prophet was, to sort of set the scene. The organisational pillars of the nation of Israel was laid upon the shoulders of three people, three organisations, the prophet, the king and the priest. And we know that the kingship and the priesthood were divine institutions. There were unbreakable rules as to who could be the priest and who could be the king. The priest from the tribe of Levi, the king, the son of the previous king. And their job was to instruct the people, or the priest's job was to instruct the people in the formal worship of the law, and the king was to represent God in the nation. The difference with the prophet was that they were individuals selected by God and specifically commissioned and inspired by God as the need arose to inspire, to rouse and return the people to place their trust in God when either the priesthood or the monarchy had failed them, or to encourage and advise the kings and the priests to be faithful to their calling. They were in fact revivalists. These men, and occasionally women, were ministers of God whose voices acted as the conscience of the nation. They were not independent of the law. They always had to uphold the moral content of the law, but they were the subjects of divine inspiration. They were representatives of God, and they said exactly what God told them to say. Now today we're going to consider the words of Isaiah, and he's described as, by many people, as the grand prophet. He's sort of likened to the Mozart of music or the Michelangelo of sculpture. And a personal glimpse will show that he was a family man. In fact, we could say he was a prophetorial family, because his wife was a prophetess and his two children, Shir Shabab and Meher Shelah Hazbat, not what you'd call usual names, I would think, they were names that bore a prophetic message to the nation. And so they were a living presence in Judah, they rousing the people to place their confidence in God. So what then is prophecy? We can sometimes make the assumption that prophecy is entirely predictive. But the very word prophecy in English sort of gives us that impression. But it's actually misleading, because the pro in prophecy is a word that means in place of. It's like when we use the word pronoun, in place of a noun. And femi means to speak. So a prophet is someone who speaks in the place of another person. And in actual fact, Aaron was made Moses' prophet. Prophecy is declaring the truth on a given subject, and it's not always predictive. And I'd like us to just bear that in mind as we sort of go through this study. Now, the subject of Isaiah's prophecy. Divine history, both in a national sense and individual sense, is only relevant to God, or it seems to be only relevant to God, from the viewpoint of how it affects the children of Israel. God's primary concern is what is going to happen to Israel, how the nation and the people impact on those with whom she comes in contact, and how those nations and individuals impact on Israel. So throughout a very long period, and often under very harsh conditions, Isaiah was a living presence in Judah, warning and encouraging the kings and the people to place their safety in the hands of God and not be influenced or frightened by the nations round about them. So just let's have a quick look at these nations. first thing that strikes you there? Well, the first thing that struck me is, where's Israel? Where is it? And here it is, this tiny little place down here. It's hard to find. And you, as you said, it's surrounded by, it's barricaded by, and it's bottled in by all these powers. To the west, I've got to get my directions up. To the west, there's Tyre and the sea. To the east, there's Moab and the desert. The superpowers above it of Damascus and Assyria and Babylon. Down here is Egypt. It's just jammed in. And unlike me, who had to look up the atoms to find out where these places were and what it was all about, the people of Israel knew them. They knew who these nations were. They knew their history. They knew that what they were like. They knew what they were capable of. And they had experienced sometime in their history firsthand the judgment and the terrible things which these nations had done to them. So I want to conclude that living in Judah at that time was quite a scary place to live. We're going to get to that. So why had God placed the apple of his eye in the middle of what you could almost say is a national jungle? Yeah. So could someone like to read out for me the red writing there, please? Yes.
Seek therefore and do them. For this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the nations, which shall be saved. Surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. For what nation is there so great who have got so nigh unto them, as the Lord our God is in all things that we call upon him for? And what nation is there so great that has that judgment so righteous as all the I
set before you this day. Thank you. So the whole point of placing Israel in this precarious position was really to save these nations, to save the nations that surrounded it, as a means of bringing all nations of the earth together. That was God's mandate from the beginning. He said to Abraham, I will make of you a great nation. I will bless you. I will make you great. And in you shall all families of the earth be blessed. But Israel had often failed its mandate, and instead of being the national model that attracted the nations to them, they followed after the idols of the other nations. They adopted their customs, even to the point, as we're going to learn a little bit later on, of sacrificing their own children. And as a consequence, God had brought his wrath upon them. God had used all these cruel and warring nations as instruments of punishment or correction when Israel had preferred their ways to his. And we've seen and we've read of these judgments in the preceding chapters. Every one of these nations mentioned in our subject today had at some time either besieged, captured, enslaved, exploited, or cruelly oppressed God's chosen people, and God had allowed it to happen. But that promise given to Abraham will and always will stand. I will bless them that bless thee, and curse them that curse thee, for all nations of the earth shall be blessed. And in Isaiah 13:23, we see that God says, enough is enough. Israel's enemies, although pawns in God's hand, remained accountable for their actions. As wayward as Israel had been, they were still his chosen people, and God would not let the apple of his eye be the continual victim of tyranny. The cursing was about to begin, and beginning with the kingdom of Babylon, we are taken through the 10 nations who were to, and in fact, experience the awful judgment of God. Now, the content of the burdens of these chapters is really awful. In fact, I put it to you that if they were to be made into a movie, they'd be R-rated because they contain a lot of violence. And the prophet, he doesn't only tell you what's going to happen, like, you know, one day this nation's going to get you. He actually describes in detail how they're going to feel, the terror they will experience, the horrors they will see, and the devastation that will affect their previously pleasant lives if they survived. And to get this message home, Isaiah is a grand artist. He paints pictures. He puts imagery before us which really will confront us. Like a modern day video clip, there's picture after picture after picture, from one scenario to another. There's strong satire that's often directed at specific national characteristics, and that demonstrates a very intimate knowledge of the people of whom it speaks. Stark and vivid scenes of cities and people torn apart permeate our subject. Yes, we can put out of our mind what might happen in the future, but it's much harder to dispel the vivid picture of the misery associated with that judgment. So the one thing that we really can't avoid today is that salvation is a serious business. And these chapters impel us to look at them. Now, you think I'm painting a pretty, you know, terrible scenario. I just think if we can bear with it and work through with it, we may be able to find a silver lining. Now, it's quite impossible to deal with these 10 chapters in our given time, so I've got a little bit of work for you to do. So, I've made up these booklets. They're just workbooks. I'm going to give them out. They contain the text from the Message Bible of the particular chapter that you're going to get. I've used that because it quickly gives a sense of what's happening. Right. So I'm going to give it to, how many nations are there? There's 10 nations. Some are bigger than others. Okay. Margaret and Madeline, you can have Babylon and Babylon's King. All right, you can find that in the first one there. Very good. Margie, you can have Damascus. You want to work with Betty?
Yes, Tom. There we are.
Moab between you. You might like to have Ethiopia. I didn't get to number these pages, which was stupid. Egypt. Would you like to do Egypt with Rosemary? Babylon. Who'd like to do the city of Babylon? If there's not enough, we can work in pairs. City of Babylon. There's a couple there. Duma and Arabia. Let's take that in the back there. Nearly there. Jerusalem. Someone would like to take Jerusalem. Would you like to take Jerusalem? Yes. Tyra.
Yes.
And the last one.
Tyra.
Sorry, I didn't see. And the last one, Philistia. Somebody want to take Philistia? Would you like to take it? Okay. So what I'm going to do, and I've allocated 10 minutes, first of all, there's plenty of pencils here if we need them. I might have got an... I've got plenty of pencils here if necessary. I want you to read through the text, and I want you to jot down the characteristics of the nations which brought the judgment against them. It's either stated or inferred. And then if you've got time... Anyone want some pencils over here? I keep thinking I'm attached, but I can walk, can't I? You right? Sorry. Anyone need some pencils? So, anyone need any pencils over here? You right? Yeah, the first thing is to read the text from the Message Bible and try and find out what the national characteristics were of that particular nation from the text which God found displeasing. It's either stated or it's inferred. Now, when you've done that, if you want to, and I've got, if you want to, because I'm going to show you some drawings in a minute, you can start to draw. Just try and visualise one of the images in that actual account, because I'd like to really bring out the strong satire which is used here. And while you're doing it, I'll just show you what Robin Jones did for me, which I thought was great. These are the Babylonians, braggarts and boasters. And this is what God says is going to happen. They're going to fall flat on their face. It's just full of this. It's just fantastic. You know, I mean, Robin did that for me. But there may be other people around here that are talented. Because actually I would like to, there's so many of these throughout it, and not only through my section, but throughout the whole book pertaining to these nations, that if we got some clever people to do these, we could put it together in a little handout. Here she's got here. Here's the king of the world, king of Babylon. He's standing up there on the mountain with all these stars. Of course, this is a little bit of a jibe at Babylon, who was all into astrology. So here's the king up here. Oops. He's the most high star. He's having a lovely time. But guess what happens? Guess what happens to this king? And not only that, but as he comes hurling down from his illustrious throne, the earth opens up, he goes crashing in, and all the other kings that are buried there go, what? And they're all buried there under their wonderful monuments, their pyramids and their obelisks and their shrines, all outlining the wonderful work they've done. But this king of the world, just gets plonked into this grave like a dead dog or a dead cat. And the kings get up and say, well, where did you come from? Didn't you get a decent burial? Didn't you even get a straight funeral? I'll move over, let's make room. Yeah. You know, it's really very good. Robin Jones did these. Yeah. And I would, you know, you may be able to, I thought if you take them home and do some of you people that are artistic, we can put them together because they're really very funny. There's another one when he talks about Philistia. Now, Philistia is sitting there and it's mocking at Israel because Israel's upset because its king has died. And Philistia's saying, this is great because he was an enemy. And they're going, ha. But behind them is a great big monster, bigger than the enemy that they were laughing at. It's really clever. And another one is Moab. Moab used to pay tribute to Judah with lots of sheep. But when King Ahab died, they stopped. So not going to pay you anything more. Tough. But when they see the judgments coming on them, they race out and say, how many sheep would you like? Would you like 10,000? No, give me 20,000. I'll give you as many sheep as you like. Just take this away from me. And there's all this satire going through it, which is really wonderful. Yeah. And then we've got the idols of Egypt, great big idols sitting up here like this, and they start to see what's ahead and they start to shiver and shake. Oh! And all the people are running up saying, help me idol, and the idol's going, ah! So they're really quite, they're quite good. And I think God's saying, can't you see how ridiculous you are? So how are we going? We getting there? There's one that I've actually done because it was quite small and I think it's very, very clever. It's two lines or two verses and yet it's power-packed. And it's the one concerning Duma. I'll sort of talk as you're sort of doing some work there. If I can find it. I'll read it out while you read, while you're working. A voice calls to me from Mount Seir in Edom. Night watchman, how long till daybreak? How long will the night last? And the night watchman calls back, morning's coming. But for now it's still night. If you ask me again, I'll give you the same answer. Now just two verses. But it's just power packed because apparently these people had just recently charged into Jerusalem and taken captive some people from Judah, and they were safely back in their land with the captives there. And so they're sort of saying to Isaiah, you know, thought Jerusalem was good, how's it going now? Night watchman, how long? And he just comes back and says, morning's coming. Morning's coming. There'll be deliverance for them. But when you come and ask me yourself, when it's night time for you, it won't be any for you. And it's all just said in this just two words, morning's coming. It's just gorgeous. Yes. It's just got that subtle irony, like, you know, the Chinese proverb of may your children live in interesting times, you know. In other words, the only type of times that are interesting are times of war and, you know, unrest. So it's not really nice to say that. So how are we going? Are we nearly there? I might start. Who's Babylon? Where's Babylon? You're the empire. The Babylon. That's the distinction that I sort of had to come to grips with. Yeah. Because the first one talks about Babylon and then it talks about Babylon again. But I think the first Babylon is actually a generalized term for all nations. It's the empire of Babylon. Whereas the other is the actual city and the fall of Babylon. And strangely enough too, I don't know who's got Jerusalem, but I'd like them to try and make a comment on that as to why would Jerusalem actually be included in this judgment of the nation? Yes. So who's got Babylon? Okay, Babylon, where are we? Okie doke. So tell me some of the problems with Babylon, please. What were their characteristics that were?
Yeah.
So massacre. Is that how you spell massacre? Sorry?
They trespassed.
They enslaved people.
They
were oppressors. What about verse 17? They were destroyed, they were unmerciful. They were bullies and violent. Okay. Can you read out verse 11 of Isaiah 13? Yeah. So I could say that they were arrogant and proud. I'm sorry for my writing, I'm not... Okay. Margie, who have you got?
Damascus.
Okay, what did you think about Damascus?
Well, they had a good start. They were really easy with Damascus because they were going to make the service. So obviously they knew the promises and had a good beginning. But they were interested in all that stuff, didn't they? All the
So they were idolaters.
Ritual.
So they were ritualistic.
Homemade religion. Their own religion, their own thing, however
inclusive
it is.
So could we call them?
Show.
That's right.
Show.
They were idolaters.
And why? Because you've forgotten the God of your soul.
Yeah.
So
they turned their back on God.
Yes, they forgot God.
Yeah. And that was pretty bad because they were actually incorporated in Damascus as the 10 tribes of Israel, if you read a little bit of the history there.
They planned to honour
fertility gods. So they'd actually turned to idols. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So they were hypocrites and they were idols. Yeah. Okay. Who's next? Who have we got next? Who have we got? Can we get, Ethiopia? Oh, Moab. Moab. Is Moab around?
Yeah.
Yep, yep. What did you find out about Moab? So they were curses of Israel. Curses of Israel. So they also were idolaters.
And the king sacrificed
his son. Yes, that's right, yeah. Can you read 16 verse 6, please? Arrogant again, proud again. Thank you. Ethiopia. Who's got Ethiopia?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Hello.
Hi, Miss.
How are you? Who's got Ethiopia?
Yeah, Ethiopia. Their characteristics was that they were mighty.
Yes.
And they were merciless.
That's it, merciless.
And they were tall. They were tall and handsome.
which I think is a confidence and self-assured.
Yes.
Yes.
Probably vain.
Yes. Confident. Oh, that's a good word. Confident, vain, self-sufficient.
So
yes.
Self-assertiveness would be the
one. Yes, I think so.
Not happy about.
Okay, Egypt. Who had Egypt? Yep. So where we've got idolaters there, so we've got...
They conjured up ghosts and seances.
So they were really into magic, yeah. Magic. Yep.
There's so much in this one.
Yeah, there is.
I get the impression that they sort of... They didn't really have a clue what they were doing.
There's a big emphasis on wisdom in Egypt. They thought they were wise. Yes. So they had a false wisdom. They were very proud of their...
I descended from the old wisdom.
Yeah, but in actual fact they were fools.
And
fooled.
Not wise man or would have left in the country.
Yeah. Thank you. City of Babylon. Who's the city of... Yep, go for it.
Well, that's okay. That they make it actually specific. It's chapter 21, verse 2. A hard vision is given to me. The betrayer betrays.
So they were a terrible people.
Plunderer, plundered.
So betrayal.
Betrayer. So they were quite
plunder,
violent.
Yeah, violent. We've got all that.
And they're
going to lay siege
on them, and I'll put an end to all the moaning and groaning. So they're quite oppressive.
They're also revelers. They had a great
then
party.
They had a banquet. They're reveling, but they also know that they knew
what they were doing.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, thank you.
So they were punished for that. And then at Babylon, it says Babylon fall on all your precious god idols. So there are other idols.
Yes, yes.
Smashed to pieces on the ground.
Yep, that's right. Yeah. Now Arabia. Who had Arabia? Did anyone? Or is that the one I did? I wasn't sure. Arabia. No. Well, Arabia were very brutal. They were known for their brutality, and they were also arrogant. So we've got brutality. Here they are again. A lot of these are the same, but we're getting the idea of what these people were like.
Yeah, they're all basic.
There. And they were taunters of God. These mockers. They were mockers. Okay, who have we got next? Jerusalem. Who's got Jerusalem? Who's me? Who's that? Oh, yeah. How did you think? Jerusalem's an interesting one.
Yeah, let's see if I can read my own writing. Are they not God, and they applauded and trusted?
Self-sufficient is terrific, yeah.
And they indulge themselves in every way.
Self-indulge?
They praise God with their greedy parties. They refuse to speak by self and they would not honour his authority.
Thank you. And if anybody should have trusted in God, it was the people of Judah.
They
didn't exist. That's exactly right, yeah. In fact, they said, look, we'll do the best we can. We'll fix up the walls, we'll put a water course in, but after all, the enemy's too big, so look, we'll do our best and we'll just party and forget it. That's exactly what they said.
Instead of showing God's character, they showing God's grace by acting in it. They went and based themselves to a superior and paid protection money.
They just ignored the God who their whole history had shown would be their protector.
Well, they took away their whole purpose for being there. So God, how could God use them?
Exactly right. And the last one, Philistia.
They too were proud of their own strength.
Yes, pride.
They were celebrated because they thought they had got back to the oppressors.
So they were revengeful, revenge, yeah.
They were a liar,
they celebrated,
and then they
see they have, and then
when Hezekiah came, they thought, oh, he's here, and he was going to get
stressed. Yep.
He was the one who struck
them. Yeah. So that just gives us a little idea of why these nations were targeted. So now we've sort of looked at prophecy in a predictive sense. I'll just put those on there, but I've had one up for you, so don't worry about it. I'm going to say that although we've just looked at these nations and what was going to happen to them, that I think prophecy has a limited role. It's not to say it's not important, because it is a useful tool to prove that there is a God. Believers, we can go back and reaffirm our faith. But knowing what is going to happen does not secure our salvation. If we accept that these chapters that we've been considering to be a lesson in history and geography only, I think we're going to miss the power behind them that can impact on our lives to make us better people. So let's just recap what the whole purpose of Scripture is for. What's the whole purpose of Scripture for? Okay, so, you know, myriads of believers over the centuries have been able to read these chapters, but they would never have had the means to work out the applications and the fulfillment of these prophecies in the literal sense. What impact could these chapters have on those people? How do these chapters instruct us in correct teaching, reproof, correction, and righteousness? And that's the question I want to try and address. And to do that, I want to try and just condense Isaiah's message into sort of a slogan that's easy to remember, so we can base everything on. And so I think his main message is this, that national sin results in national judgment. So what's our whole purpose? What is the basis of our salvation going to be? When God looks at us and says yay or nay, what's he looking for?
Obedience to him.
But how's obedience manifested?
Character.
Character. So let's call out some of the characteristics of God. Love.
Love. Suffering.
Yep.
Abundance.
Yes. I've got a little. Yep.
Forgiving.
We'll go through those. Kind, merciful, honest, sober, pure in heart, forgiving.
Love is not there.
Well, yeah, because I'm coming there. Yes.
Oh.
Sorry. It's coming. Yes. Gentle, because I think all that is love. It is included in love. It's, yes. Long suffering. Can you see any resemblance between that and that?
No.
There's absolutely, it's 100 miles apart. But, so what are we talking about? Are we talking about nations? We're talking about people. We're talking about humanity. These characteristics describe people, they describe you and me, what we may have been, what we're capable of being, and what we're vulnerable to being without the influence of God in our lives. The power of Isaiah's prophecy is found in the fundamental truth that if national sin results in national judgment, individual sin results in individual judgment. Now, or if you want to put it another way, if we act like a Babylonian, we'll share the fate of a Babylonian. Now, we might not think that we could possibly be as bad as a Babylonian. We haven't killed anyone, poked out their eyes. But just like we can commit adultery in our hearts, other, we can damage people, we can damage each other, we can commit even spiritual murder. The characteristics of the nations is actually a summary of everything we can be, and this calls for personal reflection and honest introspection. We can really damage people's reputations with our tongues. We can stop people ever seeing the truth or seeking salvation because our bad behaviour turns them off God. Consider this, and I have, and it's hard. Have I ever been unforgiving like a Moabite? Have I harboured bitterness? Even if somewhere in the past I had reason to do so. Ever exploited anyone? Have we ever gloated over the downfall of another? Well, gloating is a hard word. Let's just say, have they got their just deserts, like the people of Philistia? Have we ever looked enviously at another good person, at another person's good fortune, like the people of Tyre did? Have we ever acted ruthlessly towards our brethren or our fellow citizens? Not necessarily with actions, but with cruel or harsh words, like the Arabians. Ever mocked anyone, like the Edomites? Are we proficient in self-seeking, in self-fulfillment, like the people in Babylon? Are we sympathetic and empathetic to the poor, to the needy, to the disadvantaged, or the marginalised? Are we self-sufficient and super confident in our abilities, like the Ethiopians? Is materialism and affluence superpowers in our sophisticated lives, charging through our psyche like an enemy in the front yard? Are we affected by the wisdom of our age, humanism and egotism, self-fulfillment and self-realisation, thinking we're wise like the Egyptians? Can we be accused of ever being arrogant, taken pride in our standing in the community, in our knowledge, our attainments, our talents, our achievements? Has affluence created in us a sense of power, like the Ethiopians, and looking down on people who don't measure up to our standard? Are there idols in our lives, things that are bigger and more important than God, that we sacrifice our time and our energies for? Do we use our time wisely, or are we spiritually indolent, lounging about, lolling away our lives like the Babylonians did? Do we expend our energy on ourselves or for God? Do we expend our energy on ourselves or for others? Have we ever been guilty of excesses? Laughed at things we shouldn't, gorged with gossip? Maybe not all the time, just on special occasions, like the Babylonians. Do we ever try putting God into a mould of our making so that we can actually fulfil our need for worship, but on our terms? Well, we're building idols. Do we see ourselves as a community of people who are there to help each other, or are we like isolated little nations, each one protecting our own interests? Have we ever lacked mercy, been cruel, unkind, failing in pity, in deed or word? Is pride and arrogance subtly concealed in our behaviour? Well, says the prophet, if we continue to act like the nations, we will share their fate. These characteristics are our personal enemies. They stand in the way of our salvation, and they are as cruel and as powerful as any invading army. And I think if we're true, if to ourselves, we've all experienced in some way or another the full impact and the consequences of this invasion of these things into our lives. And you know, sometimes the enemy is not what we do
sometimes it's how we react to what's done to us. The enemy can be our response to a given situation. And strong emotion can prevent us from giving God our all. Bitterness can eat us. Anger can distort our thinking. Thinking we're misunderstood can harden us. Persecution can frighten us. And all these emotions can be so overpowering that we feel crushed, personally targeted. And it's sometimes hard to maintain our faith. But have you ever considered that these emotional impasses are a form of idolatry? If they are bigger forces in our lives than God, if they immobilise our ability to function and serve God and each other. Yes, we can sometimes feel like Judah, alone and tiny and frightened, surrounded by and barricaded by and bottled up by all these things, which we can collectively call ungodliness, or Paul says in Hebrews, the sin does so easily beset us. Well, is it all doom and gloom? Well, God is a friend of the frail. He's a defender of the defenceless, the strength of the vulnerable, comforter of those in pain, and a father who yearns to save his children. And he says, enough is enough. The prophecies that we read about here in 13 to 23 that contain such sinister messages nevertheless embody the underlying truth that God is able to overcome what in the natural sense is overwhelmingly impossible. He can destroy these enemies. He can secure our salvation because he just did so in these chapters. 10 cruel and pitiless nations were annihilated, and little Judah was saved when it learned to place its trust in God. Now, this is not a new concept. In fact, it surprises me that just how many ways it can be dressed up in the Bible. It's the same story. It's David and Goliath. It's Daniel in the lion's den. It's the three people in the fiery furnace. It's the fall of Jericho. It's the going through the sea in Exodus. It's Esther saving the nation. It's Jonah in the belly of the shark or the whale or whatever it was. It's everywhere. It's God's ability to destroy that if we let him. And it culminated in the most magnificent victory when a man, God's son, our Lord Jesus, so allowed God to work in his life that the enemy, in all its multifaceted manifestations, was destroyed completely. It wasn't even allowed to get a foothold, giving us an example that we should follow in his footsteps. You know, God can and will destroy the things that separate us from him. His mission is to transform us from Babylonians to Christ-like people, as modelled in the character of Jesus. But it's our challenge to let him. And how do we do this? We do it by doing what King Hezekiah did when he had the full force of the brutal Assyrian army boring down on him. He eventually acknowledged the strength of the enemy and his own inability to fight it. And he did the only thing possible. He took the problem to God, he prayed for help, and the next morning 185,000 of those were dead. Without him firing a single arrow in defence. So, entwined within these chapters is a message of love. I'm getting to the love now. It provides a warning
It provides opportunity. It provides empowerment. It gives hope, and it will result in salvation. Now, warning. If we are warned, we have a chance to do something about it. And that's the act of a very merciful father. And just a reminder that the warning of Israel's prophets was not exclusive to Israel. The message did go beyond Israel. And we know that because when King Nebuchadnezzar came down and besieged Jerusalem 100 years or so in advance of all this, he said to his general, find the prophet. The prophet then was Jeremiah. And make sure you look after him. Don't hurt him. You know why? Because what he said was going to happen has happened. He'd heard about it, you know. Our God is not a God, a respecter of persons. He's not anti-nations. He's against rebellious behaviour, whether that is manifested around us, within our community, or within us. And I think that is why Jerusalem is included in the list of nations. The enemy is not always outside. It's also within the house of God, and it will be dealt with in the same unbiased manner. On the other hand, if a Moabitess or a Babylonian heeded the warning, we know God would have looked after them. He's done so in the past. We can think of Ruth, the Moabitess, who when she turned her back on the gods of Moab and embraced the God of Israel, she was taken into the community and honoured. She became the mother and the grandmother and the great-great-great-great-grandmother of Christ. When Naaman, the Syrian general, the Damascus, had leprosy and he humbled himself before the prophet, he was cured. When the Ethiopian eunuch was searching for scriptural knowledge, God sent Philip to explain it to him. And I actually think that probably the greatest conversion of all time, something we actually I forget about, is Nebuchadnezzar himself, king of Babylon, king of the world, he that embodied everything that was anti-God, but who witnessed the faithful behaviour of a few Jewish slaves. And his last words were said in Daniel, now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honour the King of Heaven, all whose works are truth and his ways judgment, and those that walk in pride he is able to obey. I mean, you can't get a bigger conversion, I don't think. So having been given a warning, we now have opportunity. We have the opportunity to be a victor of the prophecy or a victim of the prophecies. We can be like the nations that were overthrown because of their ungodly behaviour, or we can be like the nation who was saved because it allowed God to destroy the enemy. And if we choose to be a victor of the prophecy, we are given all the tools necessary for God to do that work in us. God is able to overcome what in the natural sense is impossible. And included in empowerment are all these elements. There's mental and moral strength from God in time of need. There's prayer to promote intimacy and reassurance that we are never alone. Forgiveness for those times when we fail, but encouragement to get up and start again. Comfort in difficult times, a community to find refuge in, friends to lean on and learn from, even challenges to refine us. God is there to fight this battle for us and present us before his throne. And having been empowered so that we cannot fail, we have a really true hope. A hope that will get us through the bad times and the sad times. And that's the act of a kind and gracious God. And says Isaiah, in a little while it will be daylight. or in the words of the prophet, after night time will come salvation. And we haven't got long to endure. Life is not very long. And it will end in salvation. When God will wipe away every tear. When death is gone, crying gone, pain gone. So this is not a gloomy picture. It's exhortational. It's a beautiful picture of fundamental truths extracted from the message of the judgments that are coming upon the nations, and it is there for our correction, for our reproof, and for our instruction in righteousness. Now, before I close, I thought I'd just say a few quick words about the application of these prophecies in the future. The pattern of scripture regarding prophecy shows there is usually a local fulfillment and then a final fulfillment. And if we look at the map of the Middle East today, we once again see Israel. It's not even, oh, there it is. Oh, it's time to Israel. That's right. In the midst of these surrounding nations, and it's not actually too dissimilar to the times of Isaiah. What has amazed me just recently is the realisation that 100 years ago, or 98 years ago, this huge area of land here, which we see, was just called Palestine. It was just an area of land owned or ruled or dominated by the Turks. I Max did this recently, but I had to incorporate it because it was so, I thought, relevant. But after World War One, the Ottoman power lost the dominion of this land, and it was taken over by the British and the French. And these Arab tribes that were living in these lands, one by one, came up and sort of said, can we have a bit of land here and make it a nation? And one by one, it was given to them. And we're one of the few generations to see the map of the Middle East as it is today. And it's just blown me away that it's not only Israel back in the land, which we know is a powerful lesson and a powerful witness to God, but all these nations have been reconstructed in the last 100 years. Syria, to the north, where the city of Damascus was located, was only granted rule in 1945. When I say they're nations, they're self-ruling nations now. Lebanon, where Tyre is, was granted self-rule in 1946. Jordan, the land once occupied by the Moabs, was only given self-rule in 1946. Iraq, where Babylon was, granted self-rule in 1930. Egypt, granted self-rule in 1922. And Saudi Arabia, the areas of Jumar and the Edenites, 1932. And the United Arab Republic in only 1971. All these nations who less than 100 years ago were tribal people living in an area known as Palestine under the Ottoman dominion have all emerged as self-governing nations. And once again, here is Israel, a tiny little nation surrounded by and barricaded by and bottled up by these powerful nations. And I recently read that of the 23 nations that either border or surround or in the area of Israel, only three have any form of diplomatic relationships with her. The rest are her outspoken enemies that resent her very existence. Modern Israel continually fights for her survival. It's still a scary place to live. And we've seen that this week with the Iran thing and the nuclear bomb and the possibility of nuclear warfare, yeah. And the world is a much bigger place today, and other countries such as France and Britain and the USA and superpowers like Russia and all the rest of them, they all have vested interest in this area. And I think currently at the moment, Israel, she is very self-reliant and very proud. She presently places her confidence in her own military strength, and she seeks the alliances of superpowers to protect her. And I think it was only this week when the Prime Minister was over with Obama, making sure that, I'll look after you. it's the same story. It's going down to Egypt again to get a bit of help. She has adopted, that is, Israel has adopted the philosophies of the modern world and forsaken her God. And in this condition, she's never going to find rest. And we are told that she will experience the judgments of God, and some of these nations will end up going against her and prevailing, just like we've read. But eventually, enough is enough, and God will not allow his people to be entirely destroyed. His judgments will be poured out on the enemies of Israel, just like as in the days of Isaiah. And these nations are now collectively described as Babylon. So when we read of Babylon, it's a collective nations. And he will curse those that curse Israel. And at that time, Israel will learn to place her trust in God, not the USA or any other superpower. When she knows she's weak and vulnerable and unable to defend herself, Israel will be saved not by the coming of Hezekiah, as it was in the days of Isaiah, but by the King of Kings. And Israel will ultimately fulfill her God-given destiny, that in her all nations of the earth will be blessed, and there will come a time on earth when there will be peace and goodwill to mankind, for this is the ultimate purpose of God, and he will not fail. So it is interesting to watch the movements and the policies of nations as God moves them round into position for the final showdown. And things can move very, very quickly. Improbable outcomes can happen overnight, so that we never know how close we are to the last day. Actually, we never know how close we are to our last day. But while we watch and we wait, the real battle goes on in our everyday lives, everyday, ordinary lives. A battle which is far more relevant to our salvation than current events. It's the continuous challenge to submit to God, to allow him into our lives, allow him to defeat our enemies, to mould a character that reflects his own, so that ultimately we can stand with the chosen of God and rejoice with the angels saying, Babylon is fallen. That great city, that great conglomerate of ungodliness has fallen because she made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. Our subject today demonstrates the ability of our God to win that battle. Now, in our lives, against the enemy, which will ultimately be erased from the world forever. And I think such is the power of these prophecies for all generations. So I'll leave it there. Thank you.